This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Thank you for being with us again. Last time we enjoyed having you.
Alhamdulillah.
And we showed your interview somewhere in the middle of this year. And a lot of people wrote to us. And
MashaAllah, yeah, and I got positive feedback about that as well, and I think some people became Muslim as a result of that.
Alhamdulillah. So I think
that's what I was told.
I think at least we're doing something right there. Now you've been traveling and teaching. You're teaching Arabic.
I do an Arabic course in England. I've been doing it the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a month-long intensive course designed to basically give people basic grammatical skills with Quranic Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
So
why do you have to go to England to do it? I mean, in our own back.
Part of the reason is because the English, there's a group there that's organized it, and mm-hmm. each one of us can only do what we can do, and people in the United States, haven't. Nobody came and presented the idea to me. The people in England did. It was very successful, and so I've continued to go back.
Okay.
And I think it's very interesting that there's so many people that wonder why things don't happen. But the thing is, things happen when those very people wondering why they don't happen make them happen.
that's quite interesting. Yeah. Besides Arabic or teaching or learning of Arabic. Muslims in America are rethinking and looking at their educational systems. Do you?
Right. Well, we're in a deep crisis.
Why do you say that?
Because of, just what's going on around this country.
Mm-hmm.
The escalation of violence in schools, escalation of violence. I mean, sports is very interesting. The escalation of violence in sports, the escalation of violence what they call road rage, all of these type things. People are very, very, exhausted in this country, and part of it is that they have not been taught skills of learning to deal with themselves, which is part of what education is about. It's not simply being fed, spoon-fed information for 18 years and then let out into the world to do something productive. Education is literally about nurturing the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And because that has been so grossly neglected in this country, we're suffering now the consequences of it, because we're dealing with people that are coming of age in this country that have no social skills. So mm-hmm. the civility within the society is rapidly diminishing.
Mm-hmm. But why do you fault the society only? Because, look at our societies in the Muslim world. We have our own set of problems, which
If you look, though, traditionally, this is true, and part of it is our own educational crisis in the Muslim
mm-hmm.
world. There's a deep educational crisis. On the other hand, if you still look at a large part of the Muslim world, the violence in the Muslim world tends to be group violence, and is individual violence is still quite unusual in the Muslim world, and it still does bring about some surprise and shock
mm-hmm.
and concern within a community,
mm-hmm.
Whereas that's not the case in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I think Muslims still, although there's, we have very serious shortcomings within mm-hmm. the Muslim communities abroad and here. At the same time, I think there's still some basic human understandings there that
mm-hmm.
That the Muslims have that I think are lost in a lot of ways. What we have in the West is there's more of a group civility.
Mm-hmm.
The savagery tends to be at the individual level.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the Muslims, it tends to be quite the opposite. That the Muslims have not learned to work together as a group, as an organizational factor.
Mm-hmm.
But yet when you meet the Muslims at individual levels, it's often quite impressive,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Yes, but if you compare the so-called Western values with Islamic values, it appears that we have some very positive things, like the family values. Our families are intact.
Mm-hmm.
Our women can go out safely on the streets.
Right.
People can take a walk at midnight and not be killed.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you come to to this part of the globe, you have a total disruption in that. But yet you are saying that the kind of problems we have in terms of conflicts within us have a different basis. Would you sort of elaborate that a little bit?
I think that we do have, I mean, our problem, our trouble in the Muslim world definitely relates to social construction. We have not been able to create a functioning society in the Muslim world for some time now. I think there have been, but the Muslim world generally is in a type of just a massive post-traumatic stress still from the impact of colonization, from the impact of the loss of sovereignty, and also from the yoke of despotic governments for several centuries. I mean, that definitely has an impact. And unfortunately, many of our families have modeled the family structure on the despotic tyrant model. So we have a father, an authoritarian figure within the family that becomes like a despot and literally imparts those very models to his children, to his wife, and they become the oppressed within the social structure. And they move on to create their own families and again repeat the patterns. And these have, they have very serious repercussions.
But you see, the thing is that we, at least in the so-called Muslim world, the model of our societies and our government have always been that tribal, have always been more or less monarchies or feudal. I mean, these are...
I don't think so. I don't totally agree with you. I'll tell you why. I think what happens when we read history is we tend to see history in broad strokes, and we really don't have access to the actual communities that were thriving in those. I mean, if we read about America in terms of... We're going to read about all the horrific statistics and all the terrible things and all the problems, because this is generally what history focuses on. Mm-hmm. But when you actually begin to go into communities, you get quite a different experience of, say, what Time or Newsweek gives you, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to have some incongruences within experience. And I think that within the Muslim world, because it was a decentralized environment, you had thriving communities.
Why do you say it was decentralized? I mean, in what sense was it decentralized?
It was decentralized in the sense that, for instance, in the vast majority of the Muslim world, and this is still true, you can still go to areas, for instance, in Pakistan, in Morocco, in other places, where there are communities that are still reasonably organic communities that have not been greatly impacted on the dominant state structure. And there's still, it's neighborhoods, it's families that have known each other for centuries. There's human relationships that are functioning and they are working.
Yeah.
And this is part of human society. It's an integral part.
Well, that is true. And going back to, say, Ibn Khaldun with the whole theory of Asabiya, and you try to make some sense of
esprit de corps,
right, the society. But if you look at history, despite all the things that you point out, that there was a flourishing society around a central despotic government.
Because I don't think the impact of the government was as great as we see it in the history books. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that I really think that people were living in societies that were actually quite liberal in their own ways. That's my take, just because of my own experience being in certain areas of the Muslim world where the reach of government now, in which the tools of centralization are so much greater than they were traditionally, we can still see some basic autonomy within communities, and I think that was much greater than we imagine it to
no,
be
but
based
I,
on our reading of history.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying the same thing. I think that autonomy or those.
Enabled there to be a flourishment of society.
Right,
yeah.
And those autonomous...
That doesn't exist anymore.
No. And those autonomous units were structured on basis of tribes, or on some other construct?
Yeah, I think Islam was, I think Islam, we tend to think Islam was really, it was the Asabiya of the Muslim world by and large. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think that and we see it because our scholars were roaming the world. Mm-hmm. We have people like Ibn Khaldun, who was born in an Andalusian family, who becomes a minister in Andalusia. He then has troubles at the court. He goes to Morocco, a completely different society. He becomes a minister in the courts in Morocco. He goes to Tunisia. He studied in Tunisia. He ends up spending the rest of his life in Egypt. Very different culture from North African culture. And one of the things that was noted about him was he maintained his North African dress the whole time he lived in Egypt, which was part of his identity. But the fact that he could live in that culture, he was a qadi, he was a judge, working at high levels, he was teaching in the universities. It shows you that there was a basic solidarity there that transcended tribe, class, and culture.
Yeah.
The same is true. Ibn Malik is a scholar who went from Andalusia and spent the rest of his life in Syria.
Yes.
The same can be said of Indian scholars who ended up living their lives out in the Hijaz. Mm-hmm. Many, many great scholars from India, muhaddithun and things, that would go and live, and they would teach the rest of the ummah.
Yes.
And this was part of our tradition. We were bonded by a religion, but also by a language, because the intellectual language of the Muslim world was Arabic, in the same way that English now, and Persia to a great extent. Many people knew Persian, particularly in the eastern part of the Muslim world,
India,
what's
Pakistan,
now Pakistan, and Persia, Turkey as well, and Khorasan. And
yes. But that was the, in India and Turkey and all of these areas where Persian became the court language, although the sacred language
the court,
or Deva-
was Arabic.
What do you anticipate urbanization now in all of our cities is going to do? Because that's obviously happening. So at that time
it's
there was
creating massive problems.
So I think a lot of populations, a lot of these
density, high density populations. With that comes, so much research has been done in this country about high density populations. It's very clear that that all of the social ills can be, statistically again and again shown to be directly related to high density populations. That the greater the density, the increase in the social ills, and in particular things like promiscuity, violence, breakdowns of families, divorce rates. In fact, now there's been really interesting research about volume, about the sound levels and problems, cities that have very high sound levels, like traffic and these types of
noise pollution,
that there's much greater mental distress and domestic violence and things like this. And really, our nature is the way that we've been created, and our nature is that we're beings that need some tranquility.
Mm-hmm.
We need what the Quran terms sakina, right? And the home is a place of sakina.
Mm-hmm.
The mosque is a place of sakina. But when you're living in environments in which there is no sakina, there's no tranquility, there's no space in which to enable that tranquility and that sakina to descend, you really create environments in which human beings cannot exist without literally becoming very seriously deranged
But you see, those problems that are showing up here with the pollution, noise pollution, all kinds of pollution, social pollution, if you might call it, those are escalating here. But if you look at our societies, as I'm reflecting on those now with you, there is one fact is that we have stunted economic development, unstable political systems, and a number of issues, unemployment and all of that, lack of opportunity.
Right.
And these people from their lands or whatever in the villages are moving
into
the cities, and they have nothing to go for. So,
crises.
Yes.
This is what it's going to happen. I mean, we're breeding fields, killing fields.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're breeding environments, hotbeds of serious social disruption and disorder. And it's not good.
Yeah.
The future does not look, it doesn't look good. And it doesn't look good for the man on the street in Cairo. Doesn't look good for the man on the street in Palestine, for the man on the street in Baghdad,
yes.
for the man on the street in Karachi. The future does not look bright.
Yes, I mean, I think this is what I want to reflect with you.
But it doesn't
end
look
of
bright
the
also for the man on the street in Washington,
Washington D.C. Or
Los
in Angeles.
Paris, or in Los Angeles, right. or any of our major urban centers.
So then this is a global crisis.
We're in a global crisis.
Yeah.
We're in a global crisis.
Yeah. And
for millennial fever, certainly in the West, not so much in the Muslim world, and nor in the Confucian world, as Huntington would have it. But millennial fever, I think, is a serious concern in the West.
Because of the awareness of it, but our part of the world...
People sense something's going on. I think even in the West, people sense... It's interesting that the Christian broadcasting emphasizes, focuses so much on the end of time, on the Armageddon, the doom and gloom scenario,
mm-hmm.
that there's a real serious focus and emphasis, and many people... are tuned into this.
Oh yeah, that is their consistent theme. So I mean,
right.
they've done that for a long time.
And I think people feel it. People that live in Palestine feel that. They feel like these are major times. These are, you know, these are serious times.
Yes. However, in reflecting on the Muslim Ummah at large, where is the solution going to be? Where are we failing to connect with our faith? And with the reality of this world.
Where are we failing to
right.
connect with our faith and the reality of this world? I think this is probably the fundamental crisis of the Muslim is how is it that I can relate my personal piety, my personal beliefs to a world in which everything is incongruous mm-hmm. with them, and what is the vehicle by which I can transform mm-hmm. this personal piety into a social reality where it's experienced not simply at the personal level mm-hmm. but at the societal level
and to fulfill the caliphate of Ard
right?
Mission
and I think that this we're in the historical process. And this is the inevitability of the divine historical process, because we've been told in the hadith in which is a sound hadith that the khilafah according to the nature of prophecy would last 30 years, and historically we see that Hassan ibn Ali died 6 months after he took the khilafah, and that completed the 30 years, and then the Prophet ﷺ said it would move into a kingship. And we saw that. And then he said, and then after that it would move to dictators, Jababira, which literally Jabbar is a dictator, it's a tyrant. And we're in the tyrannical phase right now. And then he said, and then it would return to the Khilafah according to the prophetic tradition. Now, traditionally that was interpreted to be when the Mahdi in the Islamic ethos comes, that there would be rise up from amongst the Muslim peoples a leader. And I think that that whether or not we adhere or subscribe to that view, the important thing is that the understanding necessitates an awareness that there must be leadership. There has to be, human beings are guided by people. They are not, guidance does not simply spontaneously emerge in a culture.
Mm-hmm.
Guidance comes through the emergence of people who are guides, hudat. And this is the Prophet ﷺ, this is his first and foremost function as a prophet, to guide mm-hmm. human beings. And from amongst his community there has to be people who emerge to fulfill that role. And traditionally those people were the people that were transmitting and maintaining this tradition. We have had a massive break, and the break has come in the absolute loss of educational systems that will produce this type of leadership that is not simply focusing on the social ills. We have one group of people over here atomized, focusing on economics. We have another group focusing on sociological problems. We have another group focusing on these problems. And then we have what in India and Pakistan would be, you know, the type Mulvi syndrome, where we have somebody who's completely disengaged from the historical context and is completely incapable of inspiring and transmitting some type of serious social transformation.
We've been talking about you know, the upheavals in our own society at large, whether here or there, and the necessary social reforms and what should we be doing. Obviously it's a loaded question and we're not going to be solving all the problems, but basically here is a group of people who are the so-called leaders and here are the masses.
Right.
And their agendas are totally different.
Right.
Yes, we have the glue, which is Islam, but how effectively is it penetrating into our lives? This is basically where we are.
Well, again, I think we have to go back to this fundamental crisis, which relates to producing people who can guide and who can lead. We failed to do that. We have not done that. We have to have people that are deeply rooted and connected with the tradition, and yet at the same time able to function and able to deal with the realities at large, because we do have pragmatic concerns. We do have, you know, one of the things, and I deal with this in my own self, is the idea of is our the mythology of Islam, which is very powerful. And I don't mean mythology in the, you know, as a fabrication. I mean mythology, you know, at the archetypal level. When we talk about Omar is a mythological figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that he did exist and he did do the things that we talk about that he did, but it's at that level of mythos.
Mm-hmm.
It's something so awesome and so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is we rely so much on our mythological tradition,
mm-hmm,
that it obscures the fact that we are not doing what we're supposed to be doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is we tell stories,
mm-hmm,
about the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the Persian poet, he said, don't be content with the myths of those who went before you. Go out and create your own myths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that people can tell the myths of this period, of the people that lived in this time,
mm-hmm,
the people that come after,
mm-hmm,
that there has to be that continuity. There has to be the continual resurgence and reinvigoration of the tradition. And we're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We're failing at that radically. And what has to happen, I think, at the level here in the United States, the Muslim community, one, we have to recognize the importance of neighborhood. We have to recognize the importance of creating environments in which Muslims live together, that we're not atomized, we're not all separate, so that when we come together, the few times of the year that we come together, it becomes like the family reunion.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes like everybody's living their own separate lives, and we come together, and it's the family photograph.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lie, there isn't a family. The only time there's a family is in America is at Christmas time,
mm-hmm,
or at Thanksgiving time. So we take the family photograph and each one of us takes our copy home,
mm-hmm,
and put it on the mantle. But that reality doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an illusion in the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's happened in our communities is that we have either for the immigrant it becomes the photograph from back home.
Mm-hmm.
The experience of Islam, the Eids that they remembered back home, and then it becomes this nostalgic,
mm-hmm,
type. It's not like back home. And for the first generation and for the convert in this country, it becomes those few occasions where there is some sense of Muslim presence, like the conferences that people go to, or the Eid prayers in the local communities. And other than that, there's a deep sense of lack of community.
So you, what sort of value do you assign to these huge conventions and conferences? Are we getting anything out of these?
Well, I think that something's happening, right? There's definitely something happening. But is it what we want to happen? And is there an alternative? I mean, these are I think, serious questions and concerns.
Yes.
The what I become very deeply wary of is when we start getting into the, you know, the 90th annual convention, the 110th annual convention. Where is it going to? You know, the Quran asks a fundamental human question: "Fa'ina tadhhabun?" Where are you going? We have to have vision. We have to have agenda. We have, the Prophet ﷺ was not somebody that was moving in the dark. He was on a path, and he knew exactly where he was going. He knew where he was going in this world, which was to sovereignty, and he knew where he was going in the next world, which was to Jannah. And he maintained that absolute
focus
and conviction and absolute intention and purpose throughout his life, and never wavered. And we can see that that was inculcated in the people around him because they maintained it. And there's a natural, you know, dilution of that phenomenon as time passes on. But that always has to be at the forefront of, I think, any serious committed Muslim, that we have to recognize there's a vision in this deen.
Yes, but you see, all of us, all the so-called leaders, are saying the same thing, that we must have a vision. Every organization has a vision, and it goes back to the same sources that you and I will cite here. But yet, in terms of organization...
Well, methodology, though. You see, in order to achieve vision, Paulo Freire, the South American teacher, said that if you have methodological flaws, they're ultimately flaws at the ideological level. In other words, you have to...
If you stop right there, that is the basic criticism that has been offered about Islam itself by some of the scholars in the West.
Right.
That it hasn't worked.
No, well, I mean, that's the, I wouldn't agree with that. It has worked. It's worked at the individual level in that it has enabled millions and really billions of people to have spiritually enriched lives, and also to be spiritually productive people, not simply consumers, not simply animals that eat, drink, sleep, and procreate, but literally spiritual animals that created spiritual civilization, that created art, that created literature, that created all these things are founded in their Islam. And the same is true of Western civilization. What they glorify is really it's a result of their own the foundation in their book, which is the Bible, right? I mean, the Islamic civilization is a result of the Quran. That is the foundation. So I would say that's definitely not true on the individual level. At the societal level, Islam has had its periods. There's no doubt, and we can witness and recognize them. And probably the last great one was Osman Danfodio's phenomenon in northern Nigeria, in which there was an Islamic governance, or the jihad of Amir Abdelkader al-Zuzairi in Algeria.
Going back to the point we were discussing, the role of conventions and how the organizations here are working, you were saying something.
Yeah, I think that the part of the problem, the fundamental problem with organization is what's known as the unspoken rule of organization, which is that whatever the mission statement of an organization is, there's always an ulterior statement, which is self-preservation. And so what happens is that it's the institutionalization of any idea or any, I mean, I don't like to use the word idea in relation to Islam, but of any vision. What happens when it becomes institutionalized is the vision itself becomes institutionalized, and it becomes secondary to the institution itself. And it's, I think it was really worth studying is the Alcoholics Anonymous,
mm-hmm.
because they have a 12 steps thing, but they have another thing which a lot of people don't know about, which is the 12 principles. And in it, one of the things they state is that their organization is a non-organization,
mm-hmm.
and they talk about the importance of not allowing the organization to become the primary
right.
focus, that it has to be the people that are being served by the organization,
mm-hmm.
and this is the crisis. How does an organization fulfill its function as a service provider, mm-hmm. as a facilitator for mm-hmm. social events, for something to happen within a society? How does it facilitate that and not get in its own way,
mm-hmm.
by becoming the organization?
Right. You mean without the hierarchy and without the sort of a territorial animal farm. Right.
You see, all animals are created equal,
yes.
and then one day, but some animals are more equal than others, right? So
that's
what
right.
happens is that you have this beautiful, wonderful vision, but suddenly yes. we're dealing with people whose yes. jobs now are at stake, with people who want to maintain a status quo, that people become comfortable
mm.
within you. And this is a problem with any type of organization that is providing social services.
Yeah.
This is what's happening in the welfare state in America. I mean, social workers are notoriously burnt out,
mm-hmm.
right? It becomes very hard for them to sustain that original. Many of them, the reason they went into social work was to help people. But after working within the institution, they become hardened and burnt out, mm-hmm. and become cynical. Mm-hmm. And this happens within organizations. There's a type of burnout that occurs
yeah.
because they begin to see the dirty politics mm-hmm. of maintaining
sure.
structures. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the Democratic Party, you know, the vice president calling up people to get fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
This is the type of cynical, aspects
mm-hmm.
of any major institutional organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about Islam is based on purity of intention. Without purity of intention, there's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We have nothing. That is the foundation. And to maintain that, you must maintain an Islamic understanding throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And once you begin to compromise those basic Islamic principles, I think you really go into very murky water. And
right.
I think that's one of the major problems with the organizations.
Yeah. Yeah. But you see, you talked of two or three things, and you every time you come back with a reply, it's so loaded that I want to chop it up in different...
All right.
Sections. Now, you talked of animal farm sort of model, and so you think that our own organizations are infiltrated with this Orwellian, functionality, or I may call it.
Well, I think that happens.
Yes.
It's one of the pitfalls, and
yeah.
unfortunately, human beings are human beings. They're susceptible to it, and I personally am very wary of organizational work, you know, in this, because I can see what happens, you know, and I, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, the way that I envision what he was doing was there was a deep vision, but there was a type of spontaneity that was constant in his presence. There was this sense that revelation is about to come.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to give us direction. And so I think a wonderful Quranic example of this is Musa alayhi salam. When he sees the fire, he tells his family, I'm going to go to the fire
mm-hmm.
and get some fire to bring back, and maybe I'll get some news. But he goes there, and suddenly God wants to talk to him. Now, I think a lot of organizational people would say, I don't have time, I'm busy getting the fire. In other words, because we become so encumbered by these structures,
right.
we forget what the purpose of this whole thing is. And this is the tragedy. Musa was able to say, here's something infinitely more important than what my original intention was, and I have to be able to let go
mm.
of that original intention in order to allow something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the nature of human society is that we are organic creatures. I mean, you're a physician. You can see the body is not working according to structuralist, mechanistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's very sophisticated. And there's spontaneity happening within the body. Stress is a spontaneous introduction
mm.
that disturbs
the body, and there are spontaneous reactions to this new thing. If we're always focused on this structural model, mm-hmm. and America is a wonderful example of that, yes, it does function, it does work, but at a very serious cost, mm-hmm. at a very serious mm-hmm. cost. And you lose humanity. Mm-hmm. You lose the humanity of people.
So in other words, to restate
I know that
you're promoting organized anarchy.
In a sense.
Yes.
And I know that's to some people it just seems so crazy.
It does seem so. Looking at the end of the millennium and the need for reforms, we've been talking about it. The West is now talking of Islamic resurgence, and do you see any evidence of that at all?
Well, I think there's no doubt that something is happening, and mm-hmm. I don't think it's just within the Islamic world. There's a book called The Revenge of God, which chronicled the rise of religious spirit all over the world. It's not mm-hmm. only happening within the Muslim ranks, mm-hmm. it's happening within the Jewish tradition, it's happening within the Hindu tradition, it's happening within the Christian tradition itself. There is a basic attempt. People are recognizing that there's very serious imbalances in the world, and a lot of people are attempting to grab onto something that gives them a sense of security. Now, iman in Arabic is related to the word aman, which mm-hmm. means secure. People feel secure with iman. It's part of the human mm-hmm. nature. So I think that because of the incredible insecurity that we're having in our societies right now, there is a sense that I want something that's mm-hmm. going to give me security. And I think this is part of the fitrah of the human being. I mean, this is the way we've been created. Mm. And so there is a return
to religion.
But part of the trouble is that religion now has, there are so many filters.
Mm.
That what is Islam? I mean, I think a lot of Muslims really don't have a strong understanding of what our tradition is.
Now, talking of just religion per se, now we're talking about return to religion at the end of this millennium, mankind looking for something. I mean, if you look at any religion, I suppose you would look at it in these three dimensions, at least I do. One is the intellectual part of it, which is rationalism, and the other one is the
super rational,
right, the spiritual part, and then the third is the behaviorism or the ritual,
the results,
the ritualistic part.
Internalization.
If you see the Muslims all over the world, and if you look at these three dimensions, at least I find that we are totally off balance. Or am I wrong?
I know, I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
I mean, religion in the Muslim world has been ritualized to the degree that the spirit of the teaching is really gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the problem is because we're living in societies that there is a great deal of social anarchy, and people feel it within their lives. That ritual is something that gives us a sense of order.
Mm-hmm.
Within some of the communities in the United States, you're finding that people are going to ritualistic practice of Islam because it does give people a sense of order. The trouble is that the Quran says it's not righteousness that you turn your face to the east or the west.
Yes.
In other words, righteousness is not ritual. Ritual is a vehicle through which righteousness can mm. be carried, and it's an essential part of the human condition. We must have ritual, and Islam is according to our understanding, is the purest form of that ritual. It's freed from all of its social, these things that accrue over centuries.
Mm-hmm.
But if that ritual becomes devoid of the spirit
mm-hmm.
for which it was created in the first place, then what you have is a hollow shell. Which I like to call religion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, religion to me really is it's a hollow shell,
mm-hmm.
and I think many Western people have abandoned religion mm-hmm. for that very reason.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it becomes throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
Right? That aspect of religion is very unpleasing to many mm-hmm. people, And the Islam, I think, doesn't see itself as a religion in that way.
It is not, though. I mean, it qualifies. I mean, the word deen has a different
connotation. Very different connotation.
Yeah.
It really does. And part of this, again, is the loss of the spiritual tradition within the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm.
Sufism, which traditionally carried that banner, in many parts of the Muslim world, became very corrupted and it fell into its own types of institutional traps.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people reacted against that type of, you know, the peer type phenomenon
right.
that you have.
The cults.
The cult type situation that you find where people lose, you know, their own identities and awarenesses within, you know, a subgroup that is becomes alienated from the greater social body, and then you get into the us-them type in-group, out-group syndrome.
Right, and they believe wholeheartedly that their salvation is through this intercessive process,
right.
which is totally against the spirit of Islam. How do we, or do you assign any importance to the fact that a lack of understanding of Islam is due to the fact that majority of us do not understand Arabic?
Yeah, that's a very tricky question. I think what Arabic does is it enables somebody. I think there's no doubt that the cosmology of Islam is deeply embedded in the Arabic language, and that what the Arabic language does is it enables you to really delve deeply into some very fundamental understandings about nature, about the human condition, and this is in the Quranic language itself. I would qualify that by saying that the Arabs don't have access to that either. Arabic, Quranic Arabic, and the Arabic that really does articulate the Islamic worldview, the vast majority of modern Arabs don't have access to it unless they take, you know, study it and take it seriously. I mean, they're closer than the Ajami, than the non-Arab, because they do have some access to it through their dialects and through some of their educational background. But I would say that what Arabic is the language of Islam, in the same way that, not in the same way, but traditionally Latin was the language of the Western Church, and it was through Latin that the Church's teachings were taught and understood, and it was through Latin that the intellectuals communicated. In the Muslim world, it was literally democratized in the sense that Arabic was a language that if you did not study it deeply, you at least had a deep rooting in its script and in its recitation.
Mm-hmm.
So you literally had Arabic being read all over the Muslim world, irrespective of the ethnic or the linguistic background of its people.
Mm-hmm.
And the script tied them to the Arabic. So Persian, Urdu, all the Turkish, all the traditional scripts of the Muslim languages were tied to the Arabic.
No, the importance of language for a non-Arab like me, I think I sometimes find myself frustrated because during prayers we are reciting Arabic surahs, and prayer is a means of communication
right.
with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and firming up our bond.
Yes.
If you don't get that charge, so I mean if I...
Well see, I mean I think, yeah, that you're making a really good point, but I know for a fact that there are Ajamis that are in a much deeper state of contemplation and presence in their prayer than many, many Arabs who can understand the Quran, but they're thinking about their checkbook, they're thinking about their you know, their bank account, they're thinking about, in other words, what we're dealing with there transcends language and it moves into the realm of the heart, and the preoccupation of the heart is a crisis that I think transcends language, because you and I cannot understand the same language, and yet we can be communicating at the level of the heart. And this happens. And this I've had this experience in my own life, so I know it's true.
How do you say that, Amit?
That I've been with people who I did not understand their language, and yet I know that we were communicating. Mm-hmm. I know that there was something happening at a much deeper level, mm-hmm. a level that transcends the tongue and moves into the realm of the heart. And I think for the Ajami, that is accessible in prayer, and that mm-hmm. is accessible to any Muslim, irrespective of whether they know Arabic or not. What the Arabic does is facilitate the process, mm-hmm. right? Because language is the way that Allah has given human beings to communicate. And it is the way that he chose to communicate to his creation through language.
Mm-hmm.
But the language is not limited to linguistic symbols. It's also the signs in the self and in the horizon. The whole of creation is called an ayah, which means a sign. And sign is symbol. Mm-hmm. And so there's symbol everywhere. And Arabic is... They are the symbols through which the Quran was communicated, but the substantive matter that is being communicated, right, is beyond language.
Well, I agree. I mean, the reality of God or whatever the reality is could never be contained in any vehicle, whether
right.
it's language or
right.
anything.
Right.
However, but since these ritual prayers are ordained, how do we maximize
through that experience, our relationship? I think any devout Muslim should be committed to learning the language of the Quran. And I really believe that the language is accessible and it's easy. The language of the Quran is easy. And I know personally that people are capable of learning it if they give serious study in 2 months. The vocabulary acquisition takes longer, but they're capable of learning the basic grammatical structures through which language is communicated, and with a good dictionary can begin to open up the meanings of the Quran for themselves. That's completely possible, and I'm not exaggerating. I think a person of sound intellect can do that. They don't have to be a genius. They don't have to be that. They can do that, and people do have access to that. And for me, it's been probably one of the most enriching things that I've ever done in my life, because I know that the Arabic language has enriched, it really has enriched my understanding of Islam, and
But you see, this is a major issue for our youngsters here,
right.
growing up, or anywhere for those who are non-Arabs.
Right.
We're teaching them how to pray, but
right.
beyond that...
And it's very sad, because I think, given that we have 12 years, if we look at just education in this country, there are Muslim schools, within 12 years, we should have people that are fluent in Arabic. I mean, you can do it in much less than that. But the fact that you have all of that time, and I think it's really sad that we don't focus more. And part of it is, one, we have to get away from this, the racism that is inherent in the Muslim community. Because this brings issues.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that what happens is Arabic begins to be perceived as a type of hegemony of the Arabs over the Ajam.
Linguistic imperialism.
And we have to get beyond that, because the Arabic transcends the Arabs. Arabic is the language of Quran. It goes beyond the Arabs. And if we see the language as, that's the language of the Arabs. No, that is not the language of the Arabs. That is the language that Allah chose to speak in. That's an honor for the Arabs, that He chose their language. That is an honor for them. It's not vice versa. And therefore, the Ajami has to see that this is not about the Arab. This is about understanding the Quran through the vehicle of Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens in some of our Muslim schools is that somebody, maybe from the subcontinent culture or some other culture, they say, well, no, I want them to learn Urdu, right? Or I want them, why are they learning Arabic? See, we have to get beyond that. This is not about Urdu, this is not about the Indian subcontinent or about the Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
This is about the language of our tradition, mm-hmm. the language of our religion, the language that Allah spoke to us in. And if we can transcend that, something really interesting can happen. Because one, if you allow Arabic to become our language, as a tradition, then there a deep, deep type of asabiyya occurs. you see, that transcends. And the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he came to obliterate the idea of lineage as being what made a person Arab. Arab is not through lineage, according to Islam. Arab is through language. Mm-hmm. And he said whoever speaks Arabic is an Arab. So he was removing an ethnic
barrier.
And the vast majority of Arabs who exist now are not originally ethnically Arab. They don't like to admit that. But the truth is, many of them are from Turkish background, from Persian, from Berber, from Coptic, from many other
sources.
But they speak Arabic because that was the language of the first Muslims who brought them their tradition, and they absorbed it and they took it on.
Well, we enjoyed having you as usual, and hopefully we'll get back and start the Arabic lessons.
Inshallah. Well, thank you for...